Chapter 18. Delay. A loud rumble came through the floor. Lysel said,
"Are you planning to blow up the entire city, Jimmy?"
James looked at the others in the gloom of the warehouse and quietly said,
"Probably."
He looked at his brother in the dim light of a single lantern. For 2 days his soldiers had been making forays into the sewers, gathering information, marking the progress of the fighting above, and coordinating the defense of the city. One of the things James had known was that the demon's magic would probably result in a quick entrance into Krondor. Rather than have everything committed to the walls and nothing inside, therefore, he had sacrificed the lives of hundreds of soldiers so that the enemy would think the city heavily defended, only to discover that once inside Krondor, the battle had only just begun. Between coordinating the defense from his underground command post and eating and sleeping only briefly, he had gotten the opportunity to know his brother. He found a sadness in realizing that as he neared 70 years of age, he had only spent hours with his brother. He knew that Lysel was a murderer, career thief, smuggler and panderer, and guilty of as many crimes as a dung heap had flies, but in Lysel he saw himself, had he not chanced to encounter Prince Aruta so many years before. He had told Lysel about that meeting, catching sight of the prince in the street as he sought to avoid being caught by Jocko Radburn's secret police, and how later he had saved Aruta's life from an assassin on the rooftops. That act had led to Jimmy the Hand, boy thief, becoming Squire James, and here, nearly 50 years later, James, Duke of Krondor. James sighed.
"I could have used you many times over the years, had I known I could trust you."
Lysel laughed.
"Jimmy, in the short time I've known you, what, 3 visits in 40 years? I've come to love you like the brother that you are. But trust, you're joking."
James laughed.
"I suppose. Given the chance, you'd have had me hung for treason, and you'd be Duke of Krondor."
"Probably not.
I never dreamed of ambition like that."
The two men heard another dull thump, and one of the guardsmen said,
"That must be the abandoned warehouse in the mill district, down by the river. We stocked 200 barrels in there."
Since before the siege, James's men had been moving through the city, leaving barrels of Kuigan fire oil in strategic locations.
"You should have seen the defense of Armengar," James told the guard. "That city was a defender's delight and an attacker's nightmare."
He made a wavy motion with his hand, like a snake moving through grass.
"No street longer than a bow shop without a curve in it. Each building with no windows at street level, heavy oak doors that could be bolted only from inside, and every rooftop flat."
The soldiers smiled and nodded, as one said,
"Archery platforms."
James said,
"Absolutely. So the defenders could move from rooftop to rooftop via long planks they pulled along after them, while those below were exposed to arrow fire every step of the way. When Merman Darmus and his troops were in the city, Guy de Bastyra fired 25,000 barrels of naphtha."
25,000?
Said Lysel. "You're joking."
"No.
And when she blew..."
He sat back against the wall.
"I can't describe it. Just imagine a tower of fire that reached the heavens, and you'll have some idea. The noise, I was nearly deaf from it. My ears rang for a week."
A knock sounded on the door, and men drew weapons. It was repeated in the expected pattern, and the single lamp was shuttered while a patrol was admitted. A half dozen soldiers were quickly inside, followed by 3 civilians.
"Found them wandering around down here," said the leader of the patrol.
Rigger looked them over and said, "They're mine."
"And who are you?"
asked one of the three men.
James laughed. "Anonymity has its drawbacks."
To the three thieves, he said, "He's your boss. This is the upright man." The three looked at one another, and one of them said, "And you're the Duke of Crondor, no doubt." Everyone in the room laughed, except the three men. A young woman, one of Lysel's thieves, came and explained how things were. When it was clear she wasn't joking, and when one of the heavily armed soldiers also said it was true, the three men fell quiet. The Duke and the leader of the Thieves' Guild might be sitting in a basement connected to the sewer, but they were still the two most powerful men in the city. At regular intervals, scouting parties went out and returned, bringing news of the fighting in the streets above. The defenders were making the invaders pay for every street and house, but the outcome was a foregone conclusion. After having been cooped up for days, Lysel said, "If the battle's lost, why not order your lads out of the city?"
"No way to get the orders to them, sorry to say," said James, and his expression was one of genuine regret. "And for our plan to work, the invaders must think we've spent our entire army here."
"Gad, you're a bloody one," said Lysel. "I don't know if I could order that many lads to their death."
"Of course you could," said James matter-of-factly. "If your job was to preserve the kingdom, you'd trade a city, even the prince's."
"What's the plan, then?"
James said, "I've got a few thousand barrels of Quiggan fire oil down here, and they're rigged to pour into the sewers. Sooner or later, those bastards above us are going to figure out some of the populace is hiding down in the sewers. And when they do, I've got a surprise for them."
"A few thousand?"
Rigger whistled in appreciation. "That's nasty stuff. The fire will burn right on top of the water."
"More," said James. He pointed to a chain, relatively new from the look of it, that hung near one wall. A soldier had been stationed to guard it at all times.
"I'd been wondering about that. It's something I picked up from old Guy de Bastyra when we fled Armengar. Pull that chain, and you'll release a light spray of naphtha into the tunnels. There's a series of small, closed-off drains, pipes and culverts. I know those. The old city's first sewers. They were closed off when the deeper sewers were built 100 years ago. Well, they're reopened."
He sat back against the wall.
"There are advantages to having every plan ever made for every building and public improvement in the city. When those culverts are filled with naphtha gas, they'll bleed the fumes into the larger sewer tunnels. There, they'll combine with the existing sewer gas, the Quiggan oil floating on the surface of the muck, and whatever barrels of oil we can cut loose up here. And when the fires hit them, the entire city's going to blow."
"Blow?"
"Explode," said James. "There won't be two stones in Crondor resting one atop the other when the dust settles."
"Damn me," said Rigger.
James said, "This is the only home I've known. Sewers or palace, thieves or nobles. Crondor's where I was born."
"Well, if you're planning on dying here, would you allow me the opportunity to get a little distance away before you pull that chain?"
James laughed. "Certainly. Once we pull that chain, we've got about an hour, unless there's already a fire at this end of the sewers."
He shrugged.
I don't know how much time we'll have then.
He pointed to a door in the easternmost wall of the basement.
There's a tunnel there that leads out to a building in the Foulberg. As I said, this was Trevor Hull's and the Mocker's best route for smuggling into and out of Krondor.
So you'll send everyone ahead and pull the chain, then run like hell?
James grinned. Something like that.
Rigger sat back next to his brother.
Well, I don't fancy climbing into the daylight, surrounded by an invading army, but I'll take my chances that way, rather than sit here and fry.
A noise from above caused them all to look up at the ceiling, the floor of the basement of the old mill. The sub-basement entrance was hidden, but guards moved quietly to their side of the trap, weapons drawn and ready.
"Sounds like they've reached this end of the city," said James softly.
"Or someone's trying to find a place to hide," whispered Lysel. "Maybe some more of my people."
James signalled one of his guards, who nodded. The man quietly put down his sword and shield and climbed up the short flight of stairs leading to the trap in the floor above. He pushed open the door slightly, allowing him to peek through the door, and stepped back, obviously surprised.
"Milady," he said.
James's head snapped around as he saw his wife descending the stairs to the sub-basement.
"What are you doing here?"
he shouted. Gamina held up her hand.
"Don't use that tone on me, Jimmy."
James's rage was barely held in check.
"You were supposed to be in Dartmoor by now, with the Rooter and the boys. How in heaven's name did you get here?"
She was muddy, with dirt on her face. Her hair was dishevelled and covered with soot. She said,
"You forgot Pug gave you one of those Surani transport spheres."
"I didn't."
"How did you know where to find me?"
he said, his tone still seething anger. Touching her husband's cheek, she said,
"You foolish old man. Did you think I couldn't hear your thoughts a world away?"
His anger fled.
"Why did you come? You know there's a chance we won't get out of here alive."
Her eyes grew moist with emotion, and she said,
"I know, but do you think that after all these years together, I could live without you?"
James gathered her into his arms and held her close.
"You must go back."
"No, I won't," she said firmly. "I can't. The device is out of power. The best I could manage was to get to the market near the wall, and then I tossed it somewhere back in the mud. I had to make my way here on foot."
She moved close to him and held him, whispering in his ear,
"If you can't live without this damn city, you must know I can't live without you."
He held her in silence. After nearly 50 years of marriage, he knew he couldn't win an argument with her. It had been his intent to be the last to leave the city, and if fate decided he would die with Krondor, he thought it might be for the best. Since constructing the plan for the defeat of the enemy, he had constantly wrestled with the terrible price paid by the citizens of the prince's capital. There could be no early warning for them, no orderly evacuation. For if the enemy had thought the city without plunder and food, they would have bypassed it. More, the enemy must think the bulk of the kingdom army destroyed in Krondor. James could hardly bear the idea of leaving so many people, so much of what had been his life, to die while he lived on. Perhaps it was fear of the ghosts of those who had paid the ultimate price, so that James could buy time for the kingdom. He didn't know. All he knew was that at some point in the planning for the defence of the kingdom, James had decided that when it came for his city to die, for Prince Aruta's city to die, he would most likely die with it. But now he had to leave, for he knew Gamina wouldn't leave without him. Lysel said,
"This is your wife?"
James nodded, holding Gamina's hand.
"This is the only woman I've loved, Lysel."
He smiled at her. Her head came around and her eyes widened.
"Your brother?"
He nodded. She turned to Lysel and said,
"I've heard of you, but had no image of you."
Glancing back and forth, she said,
"It's obvious."
Motioning for his wife to sit down, James said,
"Let me tell you the time I first met this fella, when people kept trying to pick fights with me up in Tanneris, 'cause they thought I was with him."
Lysel laughed and said,
"It's a good story."
James began, starting by explaining the odd mission Prince Aruta had sent him on, with his old friend Locklear, a young son of a local noble who happened to be an apprentice magician from Stardock, and a renegade Moradel chieftain. Gamina knew the story as well as James did, having heard it a dozen times, but she sat back next to her husband, leaning her head on his shoulder, and let him tell it. The soldiers and thieves hiding in the gloom would be diverted from the terrible future that bore down upon them, and for a while they'd hear of better days, when the heroes were victorious and the forces of evil vanquished. Besides, she thought, as Lysel had said, it was a good story. Kalis watched. There was something within the lifestone. He had noticed it within minutes of Pug shifting the lifestone in time so that all could see it. He could sense energy inside, and as he watched for hours on end, after a while he believed he could see it. The Oracle's companions, when they were breaking from their mystical lessons, would approach, and some would stand watch with him for a time. They shared their food with him, though he couldn't really recall much of what they ate. He was preoccupied with the gem. Kalis relaxed and let his mind wander, and from time to time flashes of images came to him. He saw people, beings looking much like his father, and he saw things. Occurrences in places impossible distances away, creatures and beings from some other time. And he saw hints of forces moving behind those images, and those were the most compelling. Hours stretched into days, and Kalis lost track of time as he went deeper and deeper into the mystery of the lifestone. Eric shouted orders, and his men began their orderly withdrawal. The enemy was less than a half mile down the road, in strength, and word had come from Greylock that the next fallback position had been secured. Eric had decided the best way to gain back some of the time lost in the fall of Krondor was to do it a day at a time, rather than try to hold at the first defence for the extra 3 weeks. The original battle plan had called for them to hold the first defensive position for 7 days. Eric had held it for 9. There were 7 more defences until they reached the mountains at the pass to Darkmoor, and if he could add 3 or 4 days at each defence, they would have gained back much of the time they had lost. But Eric wasn't optimistic about realising that goal. The plan for the defence of the West had the northmost and southmost defensive positions being unyielding, while Eric's centre was the softest defence, withdrawing to lure the enemy along. The northern and southern flanks would funnel the enemy into the centre, putting the bulk of the Emerald Queen's army on the King's Highway, and within 5 miles of either side. The problem with that plan was that, as the days wore on, more and more enemy soldiers would be thrown at Eric's position. More than once in the first week of fighting, Eric wished that Kalis hadn't been called off to whatever crisis needed his presence, and that Greylock had been in charge of the centre. Eric would rather have had his original mission, holding the northern flank. Fighting from behind a strong defensible position was far easier than this delaying action. Now his forward observers had seen battle flags going up, as the enemy prepared for a major offensive against his position. He had planned on being at least another mile down the road when the enemy got here. Eric used hand signals to order his men out of the area, while instructing the archers to fall back. Originally, they were to harry the enemy along the line of march, but reports indicated there were too many gathering to risk exposing the bowmen. He'd improvise and find another location along the way to set them up, so that they could slow the enemy's advance, yet have a fair chance of getting away. The difficulty was that during the first phase of the withdrawal, if the enemy attacked, they'd have little time to prepare themselves. If they could steal a march on the enemy, get far enough ahead, then they could quickly dig in and defend if they were overtaken. But if they were hit while they were in the process of withdrawing, the superior numbers of the enemy would prove devastating for Eric's command. He had to get his men moving, down the road and into the next prepared defensive position, where Greylock and his command were waiting. The two units would defend that position until the enemy pulled back, at which point Greylock's men would move out, falling back to the next position after that. That would be the pattern for the next 3 months, or until they reached Darkmoor. As the enemy withdrew from the extreme north and south flanks, those units were scheduled to move down the line, adding fresh soldiers to the centre. But that phase of the operation wasn't scheduled until next month, and if the enemy didn't withdraw from the flanks, the support wouldn't materialise. When the men were underway, Eric lingered at the rear with his last line of skirmishers, who would hang back until the enemy was in sight. He looked to the west, to the late afternoon sky, and saw the smoke rising. Crondor was burning, and Eric wondered how William, James, and the others there were doing. He said a silent prayer to Ruthia, the Lady of Luck, that if the chance presented itself, those people might somehow get out. Then he turned his horse and galloped off to overtake the front of the command. He knew he had roughly 3 hours to get to the next position, and another hour to dig in before night fell. He had no idea if the enemy would march until nightfall, then attack, or wait until dawn. But either way, Eric intended to be ready. Even in the bowels of the sub-basement, the sounds of battle filtered down. The guards had been running to the various outposts in the sewers, and James had a rough idea of the enemy's deployment in the city. The fires raged through the centre third of Crondor, and fighting in the eastern segment was light and sporadic. The bulk of the enemy waited behind the flaming wall as the fires burned out. The one scout who had braved a look said thousands of armed men waited amid the burned-out cinders that were the westernmost third of the city. The palace was a mound of charred stone, still smoking, and James knew that his brother-in-law was dead. Gamina had confirmed that she couldn't reach William with her mind speech. While it was limited in distance, normally, with her family, the question of range was less restrictive. She had found her husband from miles away. James held his wife as they sat upon the stone floor of the damp and dark room. Those inside had fallen into long silences as the sense of approaching doom grew. The escape plan required a lot of luck, and everyone was feeling short of luck at the moment. James gave instructions to the scout
who had found a way to the west, and the man hurried off to do as he was bid. Gamina dozed against her husband's shoulder while he waited, and at about what he judged was sundown, the scout returned. Something in his manner alerted everyone in the room, and all listened attentively as he said,
"Milord."
"Report," instructed James.
"Ships are attacking the invaders."
Gamina closed her eyes and said,
"Nicholas isn't there?"
James said, "Then it's Lord Vicor's fleet from Shandon Bay." He patted his wife's shoulder and stood up slowly.
"Oh, I'm too old to be sitting on these coal floors."
He helped Gamina to her feet and said,
"It's time."
"What do we do?" asked Lysel.
"Try to stay alive," he said, looking at his wife.
He said,
"Lord Vicor had a fleet in hiding down in Shandon Bay, and he was able to link up with whatever was left of Nicholas's fleet after it came through the straits and follow the invaders. Once the invaders' fleet was at anchor, they were to hit them as hard as possible, firing as many ships as they could, while we set the city to the torch. As you can see, things didn't work out quite the way we planned. But if the bulk of their army, the key corps, are in the western third of the city, waiting for the fires to subside, we can let loose the naphtha in the old sewers. That'll blow the entire city under them, and with their ships afire, they got no choice but to burn."
"You say that with a certain amount of glee," said Lysel.
"It's my city," said James through clenched teeth.
"So, what first?"
"Watch my men and stay out of the way," said James, as he signalled to his soldiers.
With silent efficiency, six of them moved to a large pair of wooden doors and opened them, while two opened the outer doors. As these outer doors to the sewer swung wide, the six men on the other side were rolling barrels out of a huge storage area. Another two were attempting to work an ancient, rusted iron lever.
"Make your lads useful, and have 'em put some weight on that," said James, pointing to the stubborn lever.
Lysel waved a hand, and four of his thieves hurried over and added their muscle to the effort. The lever began to move, and they could hear the sound of running water. James said,
"There's an ancient cistern behind that wall, and that lever will drain it, setting off a very quick flow out to the harbour."
Lysel watched in fascination as the six black-clad soldiers began rolling barrels of naphtha down the ramp leading into the water. The current of the stream was noticeably faster, as the barrels were floating away from them at a good pace. One of the rolling barrels struck the side of the door and cracked. The smell of Quiggan oil filled the air.
"A little on the surface is a good thing," said James with a grim smile.
"If you say so," said Lysel. "Now, tell me again about the getting away part of this plan of yours."
"As soon as the barrels are all moving toward the docks," he said, "we have an hour or so. Let's just hope the fleet's taking care of their part of things."
Lord Carol Vicar, Admiral of the King's Fleet in the East, shouted,
"Fire!"
Another dozen catapults from the nearest ships lofted their flaming cargo high into the air to come crashing down on the ships in the harbour.
"Mr. Devorak,"
said the Admiral.
"Sir?" "Wasn't it cooperative of the bastards to tie all their ships together in a gigantic mass for us?"
"Sir, it was that."
The old Admiral was from Roldumstock, born in Rillanon, and had never set foot in the west until he had sailed his fleet through the Straits of Darkness in late spring. He had lost two ships in the passage, an acceptable toll for the early run, and he had been fortunate to have encountered only one foreign warship on the way to Shandon Bay, a Keshian cutter that had been overtaken and sunk before it could carry word to anyone that the bulk of the king's eastern fleet was now in the Bitter Sea. Word of Admiral Nicholas's death had been tragic news for Vicor, for while he had met the man only twice on social occasions in the capital, his reputation and deeds were well known. Vicor did feel fortunate that at least once in his life he was able to go at the enemy under sail, with engines of war blazing, his men ready to fight hand to hand if need be. For most of his career he had been chasing ragged pirates, showing the colours to factious neighbours in the Eastern Kingdoms, or attending state functions at the King's Palace. Now he was doing what he had trained for all his life, and if what he had been told when he left Rilanon months before was to be believed, the fate of the kingdom depended on this battle.
"Orders to the fleet, Mr. Devereux."
"Sir?" asked the captain.
"Press the attack, and no enemy ship is to be let free."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"By sundown, I don't want an alien ship afloat from here to Illith. This is Nicholas's ocean, by damn, and I won't have them sailing on it."
Elements of the Bitter Sea and Sunset Islands fleets moved away, heading north, to find those ships beached between the city and Sarth, while other ships moved farther north. The ships that had been beached between Land's End and Krondor had all been fired upon while Vicor's fleet passed, and to the last each had been burned to the waterline or sunk. The Admiral's delight mounted as he saw his plan was working. He had ordered all fire to be trained upon the first row of ships, turning them into an inferno in minutes, before they could cast off from the ships farther in. Now the flames were moving inward, toward the city, as ship after ship caught fire. The missiles raining down on the mass of ships were adding to the destruction. Vicor said,
"Keep a sharp eye out for anyone attempting to get free."
Captain Devereux said,
"Aye, aye, sir."
Lord Vicor watched as the Royal Dragon, under Captain Reeves's command, led a flotilla to the north to sink any ships they could find.
"Signal to Royal Dragon," said the Admiral. "Good hunting."
"Aye, sir,"
said the captain, relaying the order to the signalman. Vicor knew that Nicholas had been buried at sea, on the way to the Sunsets, where the squadron had picked up fresh stores, repaired damage, and sailed back in record time. But the Admiral felt what any old sailor would feel, that Nicholas still somehow walked the quarterdeck of that ship. He saluted the ship and the memory of one of the two finest sailors he had ever known, teacher and student, Amos Trask and Nicholas Condoyne. Returning his attention to the matter at hand, he saw a small ship cut itself loose near the docks and make way toward them.
"That ship, Captain Devereux. Please sink it, sir."
"Aye, aye, Admiral."
As they bore down on the enemy ship, Admiral Carol Vicor watched the Prince's City, capital of the Western Realm, burn. A profound sadness passed over him as he saw greatness destroyed. Then he put aside his feelings until later, for there was still a battle to be won. James pulled the chain. A rumbling from above told him the mechanism was working.
"The naphtha'll filter down through the drains and culverts, and we'll sprinkle through the sewers. If we're lucky, we have about an hour to get out of here."
Lysel said,
"Then let's go."
Soldiers moved quickly up the stairs to the upper basement. One moved to another short flight of stairs and hurried up that, peeking through the trap. The soldier signalled the way was clear, and they hurried out into the evening. The evening was darker than it should have been, for the air was heavy with black smoke. Men coughed, and the soldiers took out cloths, which they tied over noses and mouths. The thieves tore rags off their shirts and did likewise, one of them handing a rag to Gamina. They heard fighting all around, but no combatants were in sight. James Scout hurried ahead, peering around the corner. He waved them back, and everyone who could ducked out of sight. Others fell face down on the street, hugging the walls as closely as possible, in the hope they'd be lost in the smoky gloom of evening. Riders sped by, tattered, bleeding, scared soldiers of the kingdom, obviously in full rout. James whispered to those nearby,
"We have to find another way. Whoever's chasing them will be here in a moment."
As they retreated down the entrance to their below-ground hideout, James's words proved prophetic. A thundering squad of Saur riders came pounding hard after. It was James's first sight of the lizard men, and he said,
"Gods! Kalis's reports didn't do 'em justice."
The entire company made it back into the refuge without being discovered, and when they were safely into the sub-basement, Lysel said,
"Now what?"
"What's the only other sewer exit likely to be unguarded?" asked James.
"North Gate Outfall, but that puts us north of the city, not east," Lysel replied.
"True,"
said James, moving toward the loading ramp that led down to the sewer.
"But we have less than an hour, and that gate is half hour's walk from here. I'd rather be outside the city when it blows up than inside worrying about who's out there. If we can get into the woods to the north of Krondor, we might be able to find a way eastward."
He looked at the 30 soldiers and dozen thieves and knew it was probably futile.
"But you must try."
James looked at Gamina.
"Yes, we must try."
He led them off through the sewer. Lord Vicor's eyes widened in astonishment. The creature seemed to appear out of nowhere, striding across the burning decks of the enemy fleet. Along the way to Krondor, they had caught 50 ships on the beach, and fast-running cutters with men throwing bottles of oil, or larger ships with ballista or catapult, had burned all of them. Nearly 20 had been boarded, captured, or sunk, so that with the destruction of the ships in the harbour, more than half the enemy's fleet was destroyed. By rough count, he assumed another 150 to 200 ships were strung out along the northern coast of the Bitter Sea, or already engaged with Captain Reeves's flotilla. Now, suddenly, out of the inferno that was Krondor's harbour, a demon walked purposefully toward him, striding across the decks of burning ships. Calmly, the Admiral drew his sword and said,
"I think the creature means to board us, Mr. Devorak."
"Fire!"
shouted the captain, and ballista and bowfire were unleashed on the creature. Some damage was done, and the creature howled as the arrows struck his 15-foot-tall body. But he walked on through the fire and seemed more irritated than injured.
"Veer off, Mr. Devorak."
"Aye, aye, Admiral."
The fleet was withdrawing, but Vicor's flagship, the Royal Glory, was closest to the burning fleet. The creature reached the outer railing of the last ship burning in the harbour and stood up on the railing. With a prodigious leap and a scream of anger, the beast unfolded its huge wings and sailed across the gulf between the damaged fleet and Vicor's ship.
"Signal to fleet,"
said Vicor, as his personal doom sailed down upon his ship.
"Make best speed."
He never knew if the message got off, for Jakhan, self-elected demon king of the armies of Navindus, glided down upon him, scooping him up and crushing his spine as he bit off half his head. The Admiral had the brief satisfaction of driving his sword deep into the creature's side as it neared, but never heard the howls of pain, for he was dead before Jakhan felt the wound. Captain Devorak struck out with his blade, and, for his troubles, had his head snatched from his shoulders. The bowmen above fired down upon the creature, to little effect, while the less brave among the crew dove over the side. The two leading commanders in the Royal Navy were now dead, and each captain would have to make a decision on his own, seeking instruction from the senior most among them until a command structure could be reformed. But at least the bulk of the invaders' fleet was destroyed. Jakan killed and ate every man he could find, until he realized the ship had drifted to the northwest of the city. He hated the touch of seawater. It sucked energy from him, though he could abide it for a while. He abandoned the ship and launched himself into the air, attempting to glide back toward the inferno that was his fleet and city. Fire caused no pain for him, though it was a terrible waste of life, energy, and meat. And something called to him. Something unspoken said he couldn't just start destroying this army that he had seized, but he must use it, must move to the east, must find this thing that called to him. And from some dark source, across a vast distance, came a word, a place, a destination. Sethanon. James saw the leading guard hold up his hand. Everyone stopped. They had passed others along the way, refugees and invaders. No one seemed eager to press an attack in the dark sewers, yet. But James knew that if the invaders were flushing out those hiding below ground, the city was now theirs. He calculated the time in his head and knew they had no more than 10 minutes. They were a dozen paces from the northern gate, near the so-called Sea Gate, the gate used most by smugglers and thieves to get in and out of the city. Lysel sent one of his thieves forward, a young woman who nimbly climbed up and reported back that the way was clear. James signalled and the evacuation began. Lysel said,
"Out you go."
James said,
"No, I'll go last."
"Captains and sinking ships?"
asked Jimmy the Hand's brother. With a smile that showed only pain and fatigue, he said,
"Something like that."
"I'll wait with you," Gamina said.
James said,
"I'd rather you didn't."
In his mind, James heard her say,
"You don't want to leave, do you?"
"I don't want to die, but I've caused so much death and destruction. This is the only home I know, Gamina. I don't see how I can live with this."
"Do you think I don't understand that?" she asked. "I hear your thoughts, and I feel your pain. There's nothing you can say that I won't understand."
He looked into her eyes and smiled, and this time the smile was one of love and complete trust. Then the world around them exploded. The six men on the other side of the gate were knocked to the ground and stunned. Three who were in the gate were shot from it like corks from a bottle and flew through the air. One breaking his neck on impact 20 yards away, the other two sustaining broken bones. Inside the tunnel, the very air turned into flames for an instant. In that brief moment, Gamina and James were linked in mind, their memories unfolding together. From the first instant they met, as James swam in the lake near Stardock, first espying the love of his life as she bathed. Almost drowning, he had been rescued by this woman, who looked into his mind and saw everything he was, everything he had been, and loved him. Who loved him despite everything he had done since then, despite the things he had asked her to do that had caused her pain. Everything around them was forgotten, as they clung to that profound love they had shared. the love that had brought them a son who was safely away, and two grandsons they adored. For a brief instant they relived their lives together, from the journey to Great Kesh to the return to Krondor. As flames burned away the flesh from their bodies, their minds were deep within their love for one another, and they felt no pain. Pug cried out, "Gamina!" Hanam said,
"What is it, magician?"
Looking desolate, Pug whispered,
"My daughter is dead."
The creature didn't dare touch the magician to comfort him. The hunger was too fierce, and the touch of human flesh might drive him into a feeding frenzy.
"I am sorry," the creature said.
Pug took a deep breath and let it out with an audible sigh.
"My son and daughter are both dead."
He had felt William's death 2 days earlier, and now, with Gamina's passing, a portion of his life was closing behind him.
"I knew I would outlive both of them, but to know something and experience it are two different things."
"It is always thus,"
said the Tsar Lawmaster from within the demon's body.
"Among our race is a benediction that is repeated when a boy becomes a man and is given his first weapon. Grandfather dies, father dies, son dies. Every Tsar repeats it when they get ready to ride into battle, sons beside fathers. For there is no crueler fate than for a parent to outlive a child."
"Macross called long life a curse, and now I understand. When my wife died many years ago, that was one thing. But this..."
Pug wept for a while. Then he composed himself and said,
"I knew William was at risk, for he chose a soldier's life. But Kamina..."
His voice faltered, and again he wept. Time passed, and the demon creature said,
"We must hurry, magician. I can feel my control slipping."
Pug nodded as he stood up, and they left the cave. Macross and Miranda should be in place. Pug incanted, and suddenly they were invisible. He understood Macross's difficulty, for to do two things at once was always a problem. But coupled with the stress of expecting attack at any minute, and the worry associated with achieving the goal, it was proving to be more than one of the most difficult things Pug had done. Pug levitated, and discovered that once over the initial strain of rising into the air, it was actually easier to float along toward the city of Arsart than it was to walk. Out of the air, the voice of the demon said,
"Flyers!"
A half-dozen winged creatures sped across the sky to the south, and Pug knew that if he and the Tsar Lawmaster hadn't been invisible, the creatures would have swooped down and attacked. As foretold, life on this world was rapidly being devoured. The once lush grasslands were now withered and brown. This was an absence of life so obvious that no one would have confused it with the sleeping dormancy of winter, where the plants would reawaken with spring's rain. Trees, blackened and gnarled, dotted the landscape, and the waters ran with a clarity so profound that Pug knew not even algae lived in the pools. No insect buzz filled the air, and no bird call could be heard. The only sound was the wind.
"It is worse here," said Hanam, as if reading Pug's thoughts. "Here is where the creatures first came into our world."
"But soon it will all be like this?"
"Soon."
"Now I see why they are anxious to find new worlds," Pug said. "How is it they could reach this world, yet not ours?"
With what Pug had come to understand as a laugh, a barking sound came, followed by Hanam's voice.
In their rush into this world to feed, the demons destroyed the priests of Arsat, the only ones on this world able to control the portal. I believe that what you said about the Pantathians on your world means the demons have no allies on your world willing to bring them over.
As they approached the city of Arsat, Pug said, Nothing we've seen of Jakan says he's anxious to open the way for his brothers.
Then let me give you this warning, Pug of Midkamia. Knowledge comes with the capture and devouring of souls. This would-be Demon King may know of the Hall and the ability of some of your people to make controllable rifts. If so, when he's captured enough of your land to feel firmly in control, he may start invading other worlds.
Pug said, I deduced as much.
Then you know that even if we win here, you must return and defeat Jakan.
Pug said, If I don't, Tomas will. They entered the burned-out city and started looking for the great temple, the entrance through which the demons had originally entered. Inside they found sour bones, dead priests torn limb from limb by the invading demons years before.
It's not here, said Pug.
What?
The portal, the rift into this world from the demon realm. It's not here.
Pug let them become visible.
Where is it?
Hanam said,
There can be only one answer.
What?
They have moved the portal by magic means somehow to be near the rift into your world. That means they're preparing the way to your world for Marg. He must be close to coming through.
Where is that?
On the other side of the world.
I can't fly us around the world and keep us invisible, said Pug. I can't transport us to a place I've never seen.
The demon with the Lawmaster's mind said,
Then we must fly quickly and fight whoever gets in our way.
He leapt to the air with what sounded like a war cry, and Pug followed.